Welcome to Love and Understanding. This is John Driggs, your host. Well, today I'm going to share another chapter from my book, The Unbound Heart, Spirituality Without Dogma or Superstition. In the last episode, I shared my chapter titled Transformation, which focused on collecting all the broken and shattered pieces of ourselves and bringing them back home to awareness's loving embrace. Today, then, I wanted to follow it up with a more lighthearted chapter, a chapter on love, expressed in its four forms: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. My aim here is to encourage each of you to actively build a practice of loving kindness into your lives. Transforming our pain and trauma is one thing, but because we're habitual creatures, it's going to take time, energy, and devotion to develop new, healthy patterns. Because so many of us have been taught to fear and hate others, because so many of us have learned to close our hearts and minds, it's extremely important that we actively build a formal practice of loving kindness into our lives. It's important we work hard to unwind all the unhealthy habits we've developed over the years and commit ourselves to rewiring all those neural pathways with some love fiber. As the Buddha said, with dripping drops of water, the jug is filled. And now I bring you my chapter on love. Chapter 4, Love. Your task is not to seek love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it. Rumi. What is essential is invisible to the eye. The Little Prince. One of the yummiest parts of my day is found in the company of my family's stillness as we sit around the dinner table just before we eat. Should we have our moment of silence? The oldest of our four kids reminds us. The other kids close their eyes, and silence quickly blankets the room. Of the many forms of prayer we express in our home, there's something unusually special about our dinner prayer. As we sit and listen to the deafening voice of silence, our busy thoughts are cleansed by her stillness. Here in the placid waters of mind is that magical moment, that moment when all dividing lines disappear and each of us returns home to the invisible and all-encompassing force in which the foundations of faith are built upon. Here, we commune in love. After the waters settle and my partner and I feel that the room has found its way back home, we tell our kids we love them. As we eat, we ask the kids what they felt in their hearts and minds. Sometimes they express specific things for which they're grateful. At other times, they express their heartfelt wishes for their friends and families. There are other evenings when they talk about how busy their thoughts are, how it was difficult to connect to their experience, welcoming that too with open arms. But very often, the kids express some of the many ways in which they're connected to the rest of the world. They will, for example, trace the food that sits on their plate back through its journey. They see their food in its fullness, connecting themselves to the soil in which the food was planted, to the sun, air, and rain, to the farmers who cared for the plants, to the truck driver who drove the food to the store, to the cashier who sold the food to us, to me who prepared the food, to their mom who worked hard for the money to buy the food, all the way to the bacteria in their stomach that will help them digest the food and turn it into energy for them to live, laugh, and be. This is what our family calls wearing our love goggles. The belief frame, lens, view, or orientation, that we are all interconnected, that there's no separation in existence, that you are not apart from me, is the starting point for me and my family. It's like the exterior framework that holds and houses every other belief we have. It's the glue, container, and substance of all things. It brings a kind of cohesion and harmony to our vast collection of thoughts and beliefs, to our lives, and to our being. It's the root motivation for all that we say and do. Love, though, isn't something to take on blind faith. There is a kind of faith involved, but it's a faith that comes from your own direct investigation of love, not from some authority, some scripture, prophet, or even me telling you what it is. The word spirit comes from the Latin root spiritus, which means breath or wind, that which exists but cannot be seen or grasped. So the faith I'm referring to develops, matures, and strengthens as you become more intimately acquainted with the unseen force of love. Seek it out for yourself, of course, out of your own interest. But as my Vipassana practice deepens, one thing continues to grow very clear to me, that there is no space between me and what is known. And as this direct insight strengthens, as the barriers between me and the objects of awareness dissolve, as I continually fall back into the single realm of being and knowing, into the glue and container of all things, a quite miraculous feeling of unconditional love continues to expand in my heart and mind. In Buddhism, this general expression of heart is called metta, or loving kindness. The feeling can happen quite suddenly upon directly recognizing our interconnected and interdependent nature, as it sometimes does when we are in nature or when we take an entheogen like MDMA or magic mushrooms. But really, for many of us, it's going to take time to cultivate and stabilize, since the clouds of papancha are so thick. That is, since we have been conditioned to orient from the thinker, who breaks reality into self and other. But I'm confident the more you recognize, as a matter of direct experience, that your life, that your suffering and well-being are not apart from everyone and everything around you, the more natural metta will become. But again, because it can take time for the clouds of papancha to dissipate and the light of mindfulness and wisdom to shine through, to help prepare the soil, we can also make metta and its three related states, compassion, or karuna in Pali, sympathetic joy, or mudita, and equanimity, or upekkha, a practice of their own. Together, these are known as the divine abodes, wholesome sanctuaries for our minds to rest, sanctuaries that are entirely without borders or limits. Each is an expression of awareness, of love. But this unconditional love takes different shapes depending on the circumstances. So let's go ahead and explore each of them in turn. Metta, or loving kindness. When the famously loving Buddhist practitioner and teacher, Deepa Ma, was asked whether to practice metta or mindfulness, she replied, "From my experience, there's no difference. Love and awareness are one. When you're fully loving, aren't you also mindful? And when you are fully mindful, is this not also the essence of love?" This framing really captures the practice for me, not just of Vipassana and metta, but of life. And I find it especially useful for beginners since the framing is so straightforward. Mindfulness, put simply, is a loving and caring attention. It's a kind of posture we take in the mind toward experience. The kind of posture a mother takes to her precious newborn baby. We worship or give all of ourselves to what is in front of us, without the need to control the person or thing, or to judge it, or to make it be a certain way. We simply love it, exactly as it is, whether pleasant or unpleasant, whether the baby's kicking and screaming, or giggling and laughing. Rather than the Western approach to happiness, where we constantly try to change our environment to fit our desires and wishes, Buddhist psychology recognizes that it's not our external environment or circumstances that lead to happiness, but it's the very quality of the mind itself in each moment. It realizes that there is a much more sustainable approach in an unpredictable world. Just consider the last time something went exactly as you had planned or wished. Life, as you know, continues to throw us curveballs. We can't control other people. We can't control the weather. We can't control how we feel. Some days we feel depressed, lethargic, and apathetic. And some days we feel happy, energized, and full of interest. We each experience seasons of pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, admiration and disdain. So again, with the Buddhist approach, rather than desperately try to make everything exactly as we want it to be, we train our minds to rest in a loving, caring awareness. Just as a person wants to be seen, felt, loved, and understood, we learn to see, feel, love, and understand every dimension of our experience. Every person, emotion, and feeling. Every piece of ourself. This way, our peace and happiness are not dependent on anything being a certain way. We can remain with this feeling of unconditional love, this warm and expansive feeling that wishes well to ourselves and others, no matter what is arising in our lives and in our experience. Of course, this isn't always easy, but like with any skill, we can improve and stabilize it with practice, which is exactly what many Buddhist frameworks suggest we do. To begin, let's first familiarize ourselves with the feeling of metta, since it can be easily confused in Western culture with the feeling of love with attachment, a grasping, limited kind of love. Loving kindness is not extended to us because of who we are, a child, friend, or lover. It's not extended to us because of what we've done or how we look. It's extended to us freely, without conditions. It's extended to us merely because we are. We exist. We're bound up with the whole, inextricably linked to the cosmos, to God, to awareness. The Persian poet Hafiz captured this beautifully when he said, "Even after all this time, the sun never says to the earth, 'You owe me.'" Look what happens with a love like that. It lights the whole sky. Loving kindness is simply the generosity and openness of heart that wishes well to all beings. And it's exactly this, the selfless, expectationless, and conditionless nature that makes the quality of loving kindness so remarkable. One of the first things to notice about it is that it's always available, since it doesn't rely on things being a certain way. You can tune into love, into well-wishing, whenever you want. As the famous Vietnamese monk and peace activist Thich Nhat Hanh reminds us, happiness is available. Please help yourselves to it. We just need to remember to change the channel. May you be happy. May you be free from suffering. May you truly be at peace. Even in the most difficult situations, metta is available. After 9/11, for example, Joseph Goldstein recalls leading a retreat in which several people from New York were attending. When it came time to practice loving kindness, spreading it to all beings, the people from New York were understandably hesitant. They simply couldn't wish the jihadists happiness. After all, these terrorists had just killed some of their closest friends and family. So, rather than wish the terrorists happiness, Goldstein suggested that they reframe their wishes to, "May you be free from hatred and cruelty." And almost immediately, the people from New York were able to soften into their hearts once again. They could really stand behind these wishes. So at times when we're finding it difficult to tap into metta, we may just need to play around with the wording a bit. Is there anyone you wouldn't wish the following to? May you be free from anger, jealousy, resentment, and ill will. In making these wishes, however, we need to make sure our general tone or posture is coming from a place of unconditional love. At points in our practice, we'll sometimes repeat in our minds the words and phrases, "May you be happy, may you be free from suffering," but we're saying them from a place of greed or aversion. Now, that's not the habit we want to cultivate. So again, it's important to check the underlying tone and motivation. Are we sending metta to someone or some aspect of experience without conditions? Or are we doing it in order to get something? Are we doing the dishes for our partner because we want the recognition? Or because if we do, then we think they'll do the laundry? Are we hoping that if we send metta to our depression or fear or shame, that it will go away? Another quality of metta to explore is its tremendous purity. Whether metta is directed to another person or to our own experience, when the feeling of loving kindness is present, there isn't room for unwholesome thoughts. And even if a few harmful thoughts remain, they have no real grip on us. Insecurity, hate, fear, shame, each have the support of loving awareness. They no longer fracture us. The moment is generally one of true purity. There's a natural ease, receptivity, and openness. Also, unlike conditional love, the feeling of loving kindness is remarkably stable. In a world that knows only change, love with attachment too often turns into disappointment, resentment, and jealousy when things don't last or go as expected. The feeling of loving kindness, though, is not easily shaken, since it's simply the wish, "May you be happy." There's a confidence and strength in it. There's never any remorse or regret to well-wishing. And so the more we abide here, the calmer and more stable we become. Finally, as you become more familiar with this feeling of loving kindness, I think you'll find it to be among the most expansive states of mind. Unlike conditional love, where our capacity to love is limited by our time and attention, we can't be best friends or lovers with everyone, metta knows no boundaries. The feeling of loving kindness, of goodwill, is wide open. It can blanket the whole world. It can encompass and embrace all beings across space and time. It is entirely without boundaries or limits. One of our kids got a good taste of this the other night. My partner River was having a hard day, so for dinner, instead of doing our regular moment of silence, I asked the kids if we could gather around Mom and pour all our love into her as sincerely and fully as we could. After the group hug, our little one pulled away and said, "I tried to pour all my love into you, Mama, but I couldn't because it just kept coming." Incredible, no? When you really take the time to explore the space of possible mind states, to connect with one that is so free, so stable, and so vast, shows just how special and inspiring loving kindness is. The Dalai Lama said that if we were aware that we all contain love within us and that we can foster it and develop it, we would certainly give it far more attention than we do. How can we cultivate loving kindness? Well, aside from practicing mindfulness, we can be as creative as we want. Once you know and familiarize yourself with the feeling, there's plenty of ways to cultivate it. You can write letters to friends, family, and strangers to wish them well, to remind them of all the love they carry. When you speak with people, you can look them in the eyes, wrap them in your full care and attention, really connect with them, really try to understand them. You can hold a door for someone, pick up some trash on the street, smile at the clerk in the checkout line, count your blessings before you fall to sleep, acknowledge a good deed, etc. But because we have such deep habits, because so many of us have been conditioned to carry feelings of ill will or insecurity towards ourselves, because so many of us have been taught to fear and hate others, because so many of us have learned to close our hearts and minds, it's extremely important that we actively build a formal practice of loving kindness into our lives. It's important we work hard to unwind all the unhealthy habits we've developed over the years and commit ourselves to rewiring all those neural pathways with some love fiber. As the Buddha said, with dripping drops of water, the jug is filled. Again, build a practice that works best for you. But here are a couple ways that have helped me grow this feeling of loving kindness into something quite extraordinary, into something I didn't even know was possible, and which continues to surprise me. First, every morning, I start my Vipassana practice by asking myself sincerely and honestly, why am I doing this? Why am I choosing to sit here, looking directly at the nature of my mind? And right then, when I pose this question, I realize that I keep showing up every morning because I've seen and felt how this practice changes my capacity for experience. It continues to expand, enrich, and enhance it. It has transformed my loneliness and depression into profound feelings of connection, a connection to myself and to my experience, as well as to the world and people around me. It's made me more attentive, composed, and resilient, which makes me better situated in each moment and in each encounter to engage more wisely with the people, feelings, and emotions in front of me. It has opened my heart and mind, filled me with space, made me incredibly vast, entirely whole, and at peace. This is not only good for me, but it's also good for everyone around me. It's good for my relationships. It's good for my writing and my art. It's good for my being in the world. So I see and feel directly that my intention for practicing is not merely for myself. It's out of love for everyone. Love for my friends, family, neighbors, and coworkers. It's for every encounter I have with others and with the world. I sit here and observe my own mind because I want to be a better dad. I want to be a better partner, friend, student, and teacher. I want a more peaceful, loving, and awake world. And as Sam Harris often reminds me, the mind is all I have to achieve these ends. So, as you can see, my mindfulness practice is itself an expression of loving kindness, not only to myself, but to the world. Another way I cultivate loving kindness is by practicing concentrating on the feeling itself for extended lengths of time. In contrast to Vipassana, where I sit in open awareness, not concentrated on any particular thing, in formal metta practice, my goal is very narrow and directed. I try to spark the feeling of loving kindness and then hold on to it and enhance it for as long as I can. Traditionally, this is done in phases. Most often, we start by extending loving kindness to ourselves. Next, we move on to a benefactor, someone for whom it's easy to spark the feeling of loving kindness. Then we move to a neutral person, a difficult person, and eventually we extend this feeling to the entire world. And if you're interested in some free meditations, you're welcome to visit my website at johndriggs.org. In any case, I think you'll find this beneficial in a couple ways. First, if you make it a habit through practice, I'll bet loving kindness will increasingly become your natural state of mind. And second, by practicing in this way, you'll see your concentration increase, which will increase your capacity for mindfulness, which will increase your capacity for wisdom. And so your life will just continue to spiral upward. But again, you'll have to see for yourself. Karuna, or compassion. While love is, compassion does. Compassion is the sensitivity of heart that compels us to respond to suffering from a place of love and wisdom. Unobscured by delusion and ignorance, compassion is our natural response to the world's tears. It begins with empathy, the willingness to get close to suffering, both in ourselves and in others. But rather than get sucked into the emotion, rather than drown in the pain, grief, or sorrow of others, or even our own, compassion grounds itself in metta, in the wide open, warm, and expansive wish, may you be happy. This, of course, can be extremely difficult. When we're faced with pain, for many of us, our habit is to turn away or hold it at arm's length. Very few of us take the time to get intimate with it, to genuinely feel into and listen to it. This is not only because we live in a culture of constant distraction, where we never slow down enough to tune into our own hearts and minds, but also because many of us have built defenses to protect our tender, open wounds. When we experience trauma as a child, or at a time when we're not able to face the trauma with the full love and support we need, our bodies take protective measures. Often we learn to numb out to our emotions and feelings. We live in a dissociated state, detached from our bodies, detached from the full range and complexity of the human experience. Now, let me first say that if you're one of these people, I love you. I'm sorry for the pain, distrust, loneliness, depression, and despair you've experienced. No child of this earth should have to endure such abuse, abandonment, or neglect. Thank you for sticking it out, for putting in the work. I have the utmost confidence that if you continue to investigate your own heart and mind courageously, openly, and honestly, you'll discover a profound peace waiting to be embodied. Spiritual practice has, after all, been considered a process of healing since ancient times, and I too have found this to be the case in my own personal journey. Many people, though, come to spiritual practice hoping to skip over their wounds. They'd rather jump right into the heavenly realms of grace and bliss, free from pain, difficulties, and conflict. Sadly, some spiritual practices actually encourage this. They teach methods of intense concentration that certainly can and do bring about wonderful states of rapture and peace. Now, don't get me wrong, these have their place in a larger, more holistic framework. But taken alone, as soon as you descend from the throne, as soon as you step down from your spiritual high and get back to real life, the wounds will still be there. You'll once again face all the unfinished business of your body, heart, and mind. You'll still carry all the same habits, habits of thought and behavior, habits of moods and emotions. habits in your relationships, etc. And even if you're extremely lucky and didn't experience any capital T traumas, no one gets through this life unscathed. Everyone eventually must face a period of great difficulty. We might lose our job or a close friend. We may get divorced. We may suddenly be faced with anxiety attacks, confusion, fear, loneliness, or addiction. We might have to live with a difficult person or bear a painful injury or disability. We might face the illness or death of a child or loved one. And no matter what, in the end, each of us must face our own mortality. No amount of meditation, yoga, prayer, or therapy will make our problems go away. This is the Buddha's first noble truth. Life consists of suffering. Compassion acknowledges this, that not all suffering can be avoided, and so it opens to the reality of suffering. Compassion allows us to come close to suffering with the caring and equanimous support of mindfulness. Compassion is a great gift of mindfulness, since mindfulness helps open us to our own emotions, as well as our empathetic heart, with a receptive and composed embrace. Mindfulness lets suffering in without drowning in it, without becoming consumed by the difficulty, pain, grief, or sorrow. It allows us to accept and be with the truth of the present moment, not at arm's length, but fully and intimately. It enables us to embody the warm, open, and expansive wish, may you be happy. May you be free from suffering. May you truly be at peace. The psychologist Viktor Frankl, who wrote the famous book Man's Search for Meaning, was the sole member of his family to survive the Nazi death camps. Despite all his suffering, though, he found a way to heal, to keep his heart soft and open. We who lived in concentration camps, he wrote, can remember the men who walked through the huts, comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances. As Frankl and so many others have demonstrated, this human freedom is possible under any circumstance. And it's born out of our capacity to work with any energy or difficulty that arises. As Jack Kornfield says, it's the freedom to enter wisely into all the realms of this world, beautiful and painful realms, realms of war and realms of peace. It is this capacity that so many shamans carry, like the Shipibo maestras and maestros who hold space for us in ayahuasca ceremonies. When you sit with ayahuasca and confront all the different realms of mind, realms of war and peace, you want someone who is soft, tender, and compassionate, but who's also strong, composed, and unperturbed. The more we can get purchase on our reactions to the various landscapes of mind, the more freedom we'll have to remain in and act out of our hearts. The next time you confront suffering, pay attention to the mind's reaction. Whether there's pain in the body or an emotion in the heart, like boredom, loneliness, fear, or unworthiness, do you open to it or do you pull back? Do you give it a side glance or distract yourself with a movie, work, sex, or masturbation? Do you repress it or numb out? Do you fall into self-pity? What about when you interact with a difficult person or situation? Or when you experience racial, political, or sexual injustice? Do you withdraw from the person or situation? Do you judge and condemn them? Or do you become interested in what's happening? Do you try to listen to and understand the person? Do you feel into their heart and hold their energy, as well as your own, with the wish, may you be happy. May you be free from hatred, from anger. May you truly be at peace. Again, often the response for so many of us is indifference. Watch out for this. Next time you come across suffering in one of its many forms, see if you can take a moment to really connect with the fear, pain, heartache, or despair. Can your heart stay open? As Joseph Goldstein says, can you diminish the subtle cruelty of indifference and make compassionate responsiveness the default setting? Now, of course, sometimes the compassionate thing to do is to step away from a person or situation. Compassion does not mean ignoring our own needs. It's finding balance between self and other. So if we need to set boundaries or walk away, then please do that. It may be skillful to step away, to slow down our heart, to catch our breath, to let our nervous system settle before we return to the difficult situation. This can also be true for difficulties we experience in the privacy of our own hearts and minds. If you feel overwhelmed by an emotion, it can certainly be skillful to turn to another task, to take a walk, or whatever else may be useful. If we push too hard, we can end up making the situation worse for ourselves. So again, it's not always cowardice or insensitive to step back. The trick is to play right at the boundary of our comfort zone. Maybe just go peek over the edge. To prepare us for the bigger difficulties in life, it can also be useful to frame the smaller, everyday difficulties as a part of our practice. This allows us to see how our pains and struggles can become guides in our spiritual journey. When we're sick, for example, can we listen to what our bodies are trying to tell us and use it to heal? When our kids act out, instead of getting angry at them or shutting them out, can we feel into their deeper needs? When we're struggling with our partner, can we step into their shoes, recognize our own involvement, and see how we can be more loving and supportive, or how we can communicate our own needs or boundaries more appropriately or skillfully? When we're angry or judgmental, can we look deeper until we find in that anger or judgment a desire for justice, and then discern with wisdom the best way forward? When we feel lonely, rather than run and hide from it, can we explore whether this loneliness is pointing us to something deeper? Is it reminding us to rediscover the wholeness, connectedness, and completeness that already exists within us? Again, our trials, difficulties, and vulnerabilities are often the very thing we need to open to in order to learn and grow, in order for us to come home to our unbounded hearts. After all, it's only after the shell breaks that the seed can receive light from the sun and transform into something truly remarkable. As the poet Khalil Gibran says, your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding. Even as the stone of the fruit must break, that its heart may stand in the sun, so must you know pain. And could you keep your heart in wonder at the daily miracles of your life, your pain would not seem less wondrous than your joy. And you would accept the seasons of your heart, even as you have always accepted the seasons that pass over your fields. And you would watch with serenity through the winters of your grief. Much of your pain is self-chosen. It's the bitter potion by which the physician within you heals your sick self. Therefore, trust the physician and drink his remedy in silence and tranquility. For his hand, though heavy and hard, is guided by the tender hand of the unseen. And the cup he brings, though it burn your lips has been fashioned of the clay which the potter has moistened with his own sacred tears. Another thing to remember when faced with suffering is that there's no single response. We in the West tend to be rule-based or have black and white thinking about our morality. We look at everything, even our compassionate responses, in terms of good and bad or right and wrong. But compassion doesn't work this way. Yes, there are more efficient ways to accomplish specific aims, which the effective altruism movement is trying to capture. If you want your dollar to save the most lives, then you might consider donating money to buy mosquito nets in Africa rather than give your dollars to the Boy Scouts. But the field of compassion is wide open. It can take on any number of an infinite set of forms. If one person's heart moves her to sit in a cave and meditate on the nature of mind and suffering for decades, it's unhelpful to judge her compassionate response or compare it to another's. Maybe one of her students becomes the next Thich Nhat Hanh, a great peace activist in the world. Again, the field of compassion is limitless. There's no single prescription for what we should do, no hierarchy of compassionate action. There's space for each of us to find our own way through the natural and spontaneous expression of heart that is free from self-reference, free from greed, free from hatred, free from delusion. As I said earlier, compassion is the natural activity of a free and liberated heart. It's the expression of wisdom, the result of witnessing directly the selfless, interconnected, and interdependent nature of being. The more we grow into the direct insight of love and emptiness, the more natural compassion becomes. As Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche said, when we recognize the empty, selfless nature of phenomenon, the energy to bring about the good of others dawns uncontrived and effortless. Now, though I largely believe this to be true, I'd like to add two caveats here. First, we've all heard the phrase, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And we know that even the most enlightened teachers can, and indeed do, make mistakes. In fact, entire cultures have customs that are not conducive to the well-being of the people living in them. Sam Harris gives a great example of this when he tells the story of one of his own teachers, Munindra from India. Munindra, who no doubt had reached deep stages of awakening, did something most of us in the West would consider unethical. When it was time for his niece to get married, he took a picture of her, lightened her skin with an editing software, and put the photo on the internet to attract potential suitors, as if she were simply property for sale. Again, I tell this story to make the point that awakening to our true nature is not enough. We need more. Our compassionate responses, our words, actions, livelihoods, politics, ethics, need to be grounded in a tradition of reason. True compassion requires critical feedback. It requires a marriage of Eastern and Western philosophy. So, as I said in Chapter 2, we need to continually put our aims, values, intentions, and behaviors under scrutiny. We need to discuss them openly, honestly, and critically, so that we may move ever so nearer to truth. If Munindra is committed to the well-being of conscious entities, as his beliefs would have him, we could apply critical pressure to see if he was achieving his aim effectively and efficiently. Does prizing lighter skin add to the world's well-being? Does advertising our women for marriage proposals, rather than allowing them the freedom to explore their own hearts and relationships, increase or reduce suffering? The second caveat I would like to add is captured by another common saying, actions speak louder than words. Anyone who has ever set a New Year's resolution knows it's much harder to follow through on our intention than it is to simply set it. The truth is, we are habitual creatures. Inertia is real. It takes effort and perseverance to change our deeply conditioned habits. So yes, when we're aware of our selfless nature, the more natural compassion will be. But it's going to take a lot of practice to stabilize this realization. There's no quick fix. Something I recommend to help move us in this direction is to open more and more to our motivations and intentions. Tibetan Buddhists say that everything rests on the tip of motivation. It is, after all, the fuel that drives us. Without it, we wouldn't do anything. This is why Tibetan Buddhists suggest that we set our intentions first thing in the morning and then feel into their underlying motivations. Are my intentions grounded in kindness, compassion, and wisdom? Or are they grounded in greed, anger, and delusion? This way, we train our mind to abide in these compassionate intentions and motivations. As the Buddha said, what we think and ponder becomes the natural tendency of mind. To further build this habit, we can also do this every time we shift tasks, every time we get up from our desk, every time we get into our car, every time we step into a conversation, etc. The importance and effect our motivations have on our well-being can't be overstated. It's our motivations and intentions that set our moods and mold our postures and attitudes for the day, or for specific tasks we are performing. They also focus our attention. They shape and coordinate what we think, how we feel, and what we say and do. Someone who's motivated out of greed or hatred will see, relate, and move through the world very differently from someone who is motivated out of loving kindness or compassion. Research has shown that compared to those with egocentric goals, those who have compassionate goals are less likely to be depressed and anxious, and they're also more likely to have good relationships and feel a sense of meaning in their life. Our motives, life goals, and the kind of person we want to be influence tremendously how we navigate our lives. When we intentionally put ourselves in service to compassionate motives, like supporting, encouraging, and caring for ourselves and other people, and even the earth at large, it has far-reaching consequences. This insight has been around for thousands of years and is common to many religions. In Mahayana Buddhism, compassion is seen as the catalyst of transformation that shifts us from a self-centered life to an earth or cosmic-centered life, a life focused on service to the whole. This is expressed in the Bodhisattva's aspiration of Bodhicitta, the awakened heart mind that is committed to freeing all beings from suffering. This aspiration is captured beautifully by the 8th century Indian monk Shantideva in his perennial work, The Way of the Bodhisattva. For all those ailing in the world, until their every sickness has been healed, may I myself become for them the doctor, nurse, the medicine itself. Raining down a flood of food and drink, may I dispel the ills of thirst and famine. And in the ages marked by scarcity and want, may I myself appear as drink and sustenance. For sentient beings poor and destitute, may I become a treasure, ever plentiful, and lie before them closely in their reach, a varied source of all that they might need. My body thus, and all my goods besides, and all my merits gained and to be gained, I give them all away, withholding nothing, to bring about the benefit of beings, like the earth and the pervading elements, enduring like the sky itself endures. For boundless multitudes of living beings, may I be their ground and sustenance. Thus, for everything that lives, as far as the limits of the sky, may I provide their livelihood and nourishment until they pass beyond the bonds of suffering. No doubt this aspiration requires great humility and patience, but really, it's not as intimidating as it seems. Rather than view it as some unrealistic and far-off state, we can connect to and embody this intention every moment we're mindful. Rather than hold it in thought, rather than stuff our whole future into a bag we have to carry around on our shoulders, we can witness directly in this moment the suffering and dis-ease in the mind and in the environment around us and transform it with love. Mudita, or sympathetic joy. Mudita is, I believe, one of the most overlooked mind states, especially here in the West. It contains so much treasure, and yet we don't even have a word for it in English. But it's what loving kindness feels like in the presence of joy. It is taking joy in the joy of others, understanding that their joy is not apart from your own. It's what grandparents do best with their grandkids. My kids absolutely love mudita, and they love to recognize it everywhere, in themselves and in other people, in their books, movies, and shows. This is especially true around the winter holidays, since our monthly virtue for December is, you guessed it, mudita. My partner and I thought December would be a perfect time to wrap our attention around mudita, since December is the season of gifts. As you know, especially if you have kids, this can be a dangerous time to get trapped in the wanting mind, trapped in greed and expectation. We see others get a gift, and we're anxious to receive our own, or we even compare what we've been given to what others have received, and then get jealous or start feeling sorry for ourselves. So again, we chose to focus on mudita in December since it's a direct antidote to this kind of suffering. To give an example, this last holiday season, we went to a family party where one of the aunts prepared a game for the kids. In this game, each kid had the opportunity to win several gifts. Unfortunately, one of my kids was striking out every turn, and so they just continued to watch their siblings and cousins accumulate more gifts. This understandably made them grow frustrated and somewhat jealous. Seeing this, I took them aside and reminded them of the power of mudita. Almost immediately, this switched a flip in them. They went right back to the game with a new attitude, happy to see their siblings and cousins enjoying their prizes. Then, as it turned out, on their next turn, they won a prize. Recognizing that their younger cousin was interested in the prize that they had just won, their one and only prize, they gave it to her. Seeing how happy this made her, my kid's entire being was suddenly filled with the utmost joy. And this joy stayed with him for several days, especially since we like to point out recent examples of our virtue when discussing it in our morning devotional. When we really pay attention to the different mind states, we discover that the wanting mind is actually quite irritating. It agitates, contracts, and tightens the whole system. We feel incomplete, like there's a giant hole in us. And so we try to fill this hole with anything and everything, only to find out that the hole can never really be filled. Yet, for some reason, we keep trying to fill it with food, sex, likes on social media, Amazon purchases, or whatever, and then watch the satisfaction disappear almost immediately. When we tune into mudita, though, a sense of ease opens for us. There's no wanting or expectation. People like to be around us because they know our joy is tied up with their own. We spend less time in our heads worrying, scheming, and planning. So the joy is much more rewarding and sustainable than a quick hit of pleasure we get from satisfying our own selfish desires. There's a beautiful example of this in Khalil Gibran's book, Jesus, the Son of Man, where a young man who had been walking for some time with Jesus recounts their walk. On a day when he and I were alone walking in a field, we were both hungry, and we came to a wild apple tree. There were only two apples hanging on the bough. And he held the trunk of the tree with his arm and shook it, and the two apples fell down. He picked them both up and gave one to me, The other he held in his hand. In my hunger, I ate the apple, and I ate it fast. Then I looked at him, and I saw that he still held the other apple in his hand. And he gave it to me, saying, "Eat this also." And I took the apple, and in my shameless hunger, I ate it. And as we walked on, I looked upon his face. But how shall I tell you of what I saw? A night where candles burn in space, a dream beyond our reaching, a noon where all shepherds are at peace and happy that their flock are grazing, an eventide and a stillness and a homecoming, then a sleep and a dream. All these things I saw in his face. He had given me the two apples, and I knew he was hungry, even as I was hungry. But I now know that in giving them to me, he had been satisfied. He himself ate of the other fruit from another tree. I would tell you more of him, but how shall I? When love becomes vast, love becomes wordless. And when memory is overladen, it seeks the silent deep. Some people naturally have this quality of mudita, like Jesus, but we're not all Jesus. For many of us, it requires systematic training. This can be for several reasons. Often, we may meet mudita with resistance because we hold various assumptions, beliefs, or frameworks that need to be challenged and ultimately dissolved in order to really turn up the pressure to this wellspring of joy. A prevalent and pernicious framework in the West is the comparing mind, the thief of joy. We compare anything and everything. She's smarter, he's stronger, I'm uglier. We compare foods. This coffee isn't as good as that one. We compare people. Zoe Kravitz is prettier than Natalie Portman. We compare ourselves, our talents, our gifts, our weaknesses to others. The comparing mind is ceaseless. And for what? What value does it bring you? Why not just say what you like or value about someone or something? Simply state its qualities. Let it speak for itself. I get that contrast can be useful to help describe things or to help us decide which pair of hiking boots to buy, say. But most often, it's entirely unnecessary. Again, if it's not helping you to make a decision, see if you can simply let people and things stand on their own. Tell me about it, whatever it is, rather than compare it to someone or something else. This coffee is deliciously full in taste. Zoe Kravitz has an enchantingly beautiful smile. River has such a strong imagination. That's something I'd like to improve in myself. We even see the comparing mind in the questions we ask each other. What's your favorite movie? What's your favorite candy? Who do you like more, X or Z? Now, of course, we're often just trying to learn more about each other. Our motivation is pure here. But try to be aware of the fact that when we do this, we're immediately putting someone or something beneath another. And like I said, this attitude starts to bleed into all our frameworks, into the subtlety of our thoughts. They sometimes even end up bleeding into our relationships. Favorite parent, favorite friend, favorite kid. And over time, the critic and judge in our minds grow, harming ourselves and others. Some similar frameworks to watch out for are the competitive mind and scarcity mind. Both share the similar idea that there's not enough joy, praise, success, or good fortune to go around. Now, it's true. Sometimes there's only one job opening, one scholarship, one piece of cake, or whatever. But much of the time, we forget that this isn't really a win or lose situation, especially when it comes to joy. So again, it's important to be mindful of and challenge these assumptions when they arise. The ways we withhold, the ways we compare, the ways we needlessly compete, the ways we feel that our lives are empty and always will be. Another thing to look out for is our negative attentional bias. Though some of us tend to focus on what we like and love about everything, many of us tend to focus on the negative, on what's wrong, broken, ugly, disgusting, or imperfect. And of course, not everything is good and beautiful in the world. There's much that is unacceptable. And to be the adult in their room, we can't live with rose-tinted glasses. We must acknowledge the ugly. When we cultivate joy and mudita, though, we learn that the bad, ugly, and heartbreaking in life live side by side with the good, beautiful, and heartwarming. There will always be things in our lives that need our care and attention, but that doesn't erase all that's good and well. If you explore your body, heart, and mind right now, there may be places of discomfort and pain, objects that are unpleasant. But there are also probably many places that are pleasant or at ease. For me, the whole house can be perfectly clean, except for someone's dish in the sink. And the dish will consume me. I have so many other things to take delight in. The clean laundry, the mopped floors, the beautifully organized living room and bedroom. But I choose to dwell in misery over the tiniest dirty dish. So really, joy and mudita are a training of attention. We can learn to spend less time fixating on the negative, on what we don't have, on the bad, ugly, and heartbreaking, and spend more time on the positive, on what we do have, on the good, beautiful, and heartwarming. Building up our gratitude muscle helps a lot here. A simple journal where we list 3 to 5 gratitudes a day can go a long way. And they can be as simple as your morning coffee, the lungs that allow you to breathe, or the heart that keeps your blood flowing. Again, what we think and ponder becomes the tendency of our minds. Another place we can train to keep our attention is on the absence or waning of suffering. As Thich Nhat Hanh said, we always notice when we have a toothache, but why do we forget to enjoy all the moments when we don't have a toothache? The Buddha also pointed out quite directly where to find joy, in the subsiding of what are called the hindrances or afflictive qualities of mind: desire, aversion, lethargy, restlessness, and doubt. See if, the Buddha asks us, being freed from the grip of desire is like being released from a debt. See if being freed from aversion feels like recovering from an illness. See if being freed from lethargy feels like being released from a dark prison cell. See if escaping anxiety and worry feels like being emancipated from slavery. And see if making it through doubt is like getting out of a desert alive. As a bonus, when we pay closer attention to the subsiding of the hindrances, we become less likely to get captured in them. We learn, for example, that we can simply let this desire or worry pass, and instead, we can be with the greater ease that comes from renunciation. Okay, there's one last shift in framing I suggest, which I've been dancing around this whole time. I encourage you to think of joy not as something that happens to us when all the stars align, not something we have to wait to receive, but something we can offer as a gift to the world at any time. When we see directly for ourselves that we have the capacity to generate joy internally, it changes our relationship with the world. We stop pursuing so desperately external things to make us happy. This, of course, doesn't mean we stop appreciating all that is good and lovely in the world. We can still enjoy sex with our partner. We can still delight in the taste of coffee or the warmth of our shower. But our joy is no longer hostage to external conditions. Upekkha, or equanimity. Equanimity is what makes love, compassion, mudita, and freedom possible. It's the balance and evenness of mind we cultivate in mindfulness practice. The capacity of mind to allow all things in without being controlled or consumed by them. So it's not only the fertile ground for wisdom, but it's also the great defender of the divine abodes, since it allows us to stay on the log, as my kids say. It's what allows us to not get lured by desire or pushed away by aversion. It's one of the surest signs of spiritual maturity. And when it's well cultivated, it gives rise to an extraordinary sense of peace. A peace that is not only felt internally, but which others can feel in our presence. The Buddha described a mind filled with equanimity as abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. Equanimity is translated from two Pali words, upekkha and tatra maja hatata. Upekkha, the more common term, means to look over and refers to the equanimity that arises from the power of pure observation, the ability to see without being caught by what we see. In India, the word was sometimes used in common speech to mean to see with patience. And tatra maja tata is a long compound of simple Pali words. The first, tatra, means there. Maja means middle, and tata means to stand or to pose. Together then, the word means to stand there in the middle. It is to remain balanced, to be with whatever is happening, to not lean forward or pull away, but to stay on top of your feet, open to what's here. This balancing function has two specific applications that are relevant to our discussion. The first applies to our practice of dwelling in the divine abodes, loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy. And the second applies to maintaining composure against what are called the great vicissitudes of life, or the eight worldly winds: pleasure and pain, praise and blame, success and failure, fame and disrepute. With the first balancing function, equanimity is crucial because it helps us hold a balanced view of conscious beings, an unbiased impartiality, a mind without attachment or hostility, which is necessary to remain in the divine abodes. This practice carries the potential to veer off into what is called the near enemies of the divine abodes. Loving kindness can easily get mixed up with desire and attachment. Compassion can easily turn into pity, where we hold a subtle superiority over the person we pity instead of honoring, understanding, and respecting them. And mudita, when we're not careful, can fall into automatic pleasantry, or what is sometimes called toxic positivity, a kind of attachment to frivolous joys, or an unwillingness to be real about the truth of sorrow in our lives and in the lives of those around us. So we need equanimity to act as the fulcrum, to balance self and other equally, and to balance the different energies that arise within ourselves as well. To practice, then, we need to work with our natural tendencies to grasp at those we love, reject those we don't like, and ignore those who fall through the cracks. One simple way to work with our tendency to grasp at those we love, especially our partner or spouse or kids, is by asking the simple question, how can I love this person more without asking for anything in return? Do this, and I bet you'll be surprised how often your love is tied up with some condition or expectation. Let me hover over the relationships we have with our kids for a moment, an area in our lives where this balance tends to be particularly difficult. We carry so many conscious and unconscious demands and expectations for our kids. Many of us try to force our interests, hobbies, and beliefs on them, and then get hurt or frustrated when they don't take. A common theme I see not only in the Mormon culture, but in all the Abrahamic religions, as well as in Hinduism, is the priority many parents give to their religion over their kids. Many parents of the world's faiths are simply unwilling to accept or come to terms with their children's decision to leave the faith, And so they end up holding their love hostage in some way. This is not the God I know, unconditional love. So please watch out for this. As Khalil Gibran says in his poem on children, your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you yet, they belong not to you. You may give them your love, but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you. For life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday. You are the bows from which your children, as living arrows, are sent forth. The archer sees the mark upon the path of the infinite, and he bends you with his might, that his arrows may go swift and far. Let your bending in the archer's hand be for gladness, for even as he loves the arrow that flies, so he loves also the bow that is stable. Okay, switching now to the difficult people in our lives, it can be useful to reframe our relationship with them by viewing them as our teachers. It's easy to be loving and mindful when everything is going along smoothly, but there's no real growth in this. Character is wrought by pain. It's only because of our difficulties, including the difficult people in our lives, that we can deepen our practice. So the next time you interact with a difficult person, whether it's your boss, a parent, a neighbor, see if you can take it as an opportunity to practice. The Buddha set a high standard when he said, even if robbers and murderers saw through your limbs and joints, let us not give away to anger. Undisturbed shall our minds remain, with hearts full of love, free from any hidden malice, penetrating that person with loving thoughts, wide, deep, and boundless, freed from anger and hatred. Now, of course, I'm not asking you to take it this far, but maybe see if you can recognize the pain behind this difficult person's face. Recognize all the circumstances and hardships that brought this person to where they are. And then meet him or her with the wish, may you be free from suffering. May you be free from anger, hatred, and cruelty. May you be at peace. You can even imagine this person as a young child if it helps. In doing this, however, keep close the wisdom of no. Remember, it's okay to say no to cruelty. It's okay to say no to abuse, to say no to racism, to say no to violence. As Jack Kornfield said, there's a yes in compassion, and there's also a no, said with the same courage of heart. This is known in Buddhism as the fierce sword of compassion. It's the powerful no of leaving a cruel and destructive family. It's the agonizing no of allowing an addict to feel the consequences of their actions without it taking over our own lives. It's the heart-wrenching no that removes ourselves and our precious children from abusive partners. Sharon Salzberg, a famous practitioner of metta and grandmother of mindfulness in the West, tells a story of her time in India that really captures the wisdom of no. One night, she and her friend were on their way back to the monastery when a man aggressively robbed them. Once they made it back to the monastery, they told their teacher all about the incident. The teacher listened intently and, when they were done speaking, said something like, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry. I'm glad you're all right. You should have taken your umbrella and hit that man with all the love in your heart. This is an important lesson, especially in today's times. There are many parents I know of who have swung too far in the other direction from our parents' generation, who were a bit too strict and demanding. But love often requires sternness. Can you imagine if we never said no to our children? What a nightmare that would be. So again, saying no is an important part of the spiritual journey. We need to know our boundaries, and we need to know how to communicate and defend them. We just need to make sure we're doing it from a place of love and wisdom. When I use my low, stern voice with our dogs, after they've torn up toilet paper or gone potty in the house, I turn to my kids and wink at them. It's responding from a place of love, not from a place of hatred or anger. Spiritual practice often emphasizes acceptance. Accept things as they are. But again, you don't have to go along with anything and everything. In fact, please don't. Equanimity doesn't mean passivity. It means understanding the situation clearly so we can respond from a place of wisdom rather than react automatically or habitually. I think James Baldwin captures this balance beautifully in his essay, Notes of a Native Son. It began to seem that one would have to hold in the mind forever two ideas which seemed to be in opposition. The first idea was acceptance, the acceptance totally without rancor, of life as it is, and men as they are. In the light of this idea, it goes without saying that injustice is a commonplace. But this did not mean that one could be complacent, for the second idea was of equal power, that one must never, in one's own life, accept these injustices as commonplace, but must fight them with all one's strength. This fight begins, however, in the heart, and it now had been laid to my charge to keep my own heart free of hatred and despair. Finally, with neutral people, to break the habit of being indifferent towards them, we can simply acknowledge them. When we take a walk or drive in the car or stand in the checkout line, we can also ask ourselves if we genuinely want them to have a good day, if we genuinely want them to get where they're going safely. We can see if we want them to have someone in their life who loves and cares for them. Look and see if you really do hold these wishes for them. Most of us, most of the time, if we're merely willing to look, really do want others to be happy, to be safe and secure, to be free from suffering. Often, though, we just need this quality of equanimity, this balanced and unbiased impartiality, to help open us to the whole field of conscious entities. There's a great example of this in the movie Her by Spike Jonze. As the two main characters, Theodore and Samantha, are enjoying a night out together, they try to put stories to the people around them. After Samantha talks about a couple eating pizza with whom Samantha believes to be their kids, Theodore responds, "I don't think they're his kids. He's a little formal with them. I think it's a new relationship. I love how he looks at her and how relaxed she is with him. You know, she's only dated fucking pricks. And now she's finally met this guy who's so sweet. I mean, look at him. He's like the sweetest guy in the world. I kind of want to spoon him." Samantha responds, "That's a good skill you have. You're very perceptive." "Yeah," says Theodore. "You know, sometimes I look at people and make myself try and feel them as more than just a random person walking by. I imagine how deeply they've fallen in love or how much heartbreak they've all been through." "Hmm," says Samantha. "I can feel that in your writing." This is a great way to balance out the indifference we feel towards strangers. When we realize that they have the exact same capacity for joy and sorrow as we do, when we realize that awareness sits at their foundation just as it does our own, when we realize that every experience is arising within the same unbound ocean of awareness, then we can begin to even out our biases and prejudices and open to the entire field of experience, of suchness, of beingness. If we don't practice, our love and compassion will likely remain limited. We'll tend to think only about ourselves and those close to us and miss the potential to feel a much bigger love, a boundless love. Now, of course, this is perfectly normal. Evolution didn't carve out the impulse to love and protect strangers, but rather to protect those closest to us. But as we grow more mindful, as our meta-awareness increases, we can imagine and cultivate much grander possibilities, infinite possibilities. We can cover the entire world with the wish, may you be happy. Okay, let's switch now to the second application of equanimity, which involves what are called the eight worldly winds or vicissitudes, the polarities of experience that are unavoidable in life. Pleasure and pain, praise and blame, success and failure, fame and disrepute. Because these winds are forever blowing and changing, they create uncertainty at every step in our journey. We simply don't know what's around the next corner. When we cultivate equanimity, though, we remain balanced. We stand there in the middleness of it all. We learn to be at ease with these winds by understanding that they're transient, that they'll pass. Again, Gibbon captures this beautifully in his poem titled On Joy and Sorrow. Your joy is your sorrow unmasked, and the self-same well from which your laughter rises was oftentimes filled with your tears. And how else can it be? The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. Is not the cup that holds your wine the very cup that was burned in the potter's oven? And is not the lute that soothes your spirit the very wood that was hollowed with knives? When you are joyous, look deep into your heart, and you shall find it is only that which has given you sorrow that is giving you joy. When you are sorrowful, look again in your heart, and you shall see that in truth you are weeping for that which has been your delight. Some of you say, joy is greater than sorrow, and others say, nay, sorrow is the greater. But I say unto you, they are inseparable. Together they come, and when one sits alone with you at your board, remember that the other is asleep upon your bed. Verily, you are suspended like scales between your sorrow and your joy. Only when you are empty are you at standstill and balanced. When the treasure keeper lifts you to weigh his gold and his silver, needs must your joy or your sorrow rise or fall. By embracing both joy and sorrow, we grow our capacity to be with either, being able to openly enjoy pleasure, knowing full well that it will fade, is what also allows us to stay open to pain, since we know it too will fade all on its own. There's no need to struggle. We can delight in the joy of warm sand between our toes at the beach without desperately hanging on to the moment. And we can fully be with the grief of losing a loved one, seeing them both with wisdom. Of course, equanimity doesn't make the pain go away, but it helps us to understand that resisting the pain or contracting around it only makes the pain worse. The wise grandmother is often used as a symbol of equanimity, for equanimity looks upon the whole project of our lives like a grandmother watches her grandchildren grow and develop. She sees them experience the highest highs and lowest lows with a collected and loving composure. She feels deeply and strongly for each of them, but because she has a much bigger perspective, she can take appropriate action, laugh with them, cry with them, help them learn from their mistakes, nudge them in a particular direction, and even discipline them when she needs. All with a sense of ease. She's been on this roller coaster for a long time, and has seen her own children on this ride for some time now, too. And so she's learned to relax into it. So how do we become more like grandma? Or to look at the question from upside down, what is it that prevents us from abiding in equanimity? Well, often it's our framing, our beliefs. When things don't go our way, when our expectations are upset, when our wishes don't come true, then we tend to judge, condemn, and blame reality for how it is. Fyodor Dostoevsky defined man as ungrateful and walks on hind legs. Sadly, this is all too true for so many of us, much of the time. We expect the entire world to revolve around us and our wishes, and then we're miserable to be around when the world inevitably doesn't go our way. This is the opposite of wisdom. It's the direct path to suffering. Resisting, judging, condemning, and blaming life, or reality, or the Dharma. Again, equanimity doesn't mean that we like or are happy about what happened. Many things in life are unfair or cruel, and it's okay to recognize that. Sometimes the most innocent are harmed, the most generous lose everything, and the most loving are hated and protested. Kids get cancer. Black men and boys in some parts of the U.S. have to worry about the very people who are supposed to protect them. Women are treated like second-class citizens across the world, and on and on. Again, equanimity doesn't deny any of this. It simply allows us to weather the storm, to plant our roots deep into the earth, into the soil of wisdom. It asks us to open to and unconditionally accept the truth of the moment's experience, the anger, pain, embarrassment, remorse, or boredom. And then from that clarity, we can respond wisely, lovingly, skillfully, and appropriately. A great way to start practicing is by applying equanimity to the very reactivity we're trying to diminish. When we react rather than respond with equanimity to pain, disgust, or whatever it may be, we can learn to tolerate and accept our reactions with kindness. We can even do this in our meditation practice when we judge ourselves after we realize we've been captured by thought. Rather than double down on the reaction by condemning or judging ourselves, we can work on being tolerant and accepting of our conditioned habits or reactions. This way, rather than getting stuck in a loop of reactivity, we learn to step back into a more spacious perspective and meet our reaction with the warm, welcoming radiance of equanimity. Another way to practice cultivating equanimity is by becoming a student of the many ways we get caught. Rather than pursue some ideal of equanimity, we can know how we fall off the log. We can explore our triggers. This is where having a good Dharma friend comes in handy. We can ask them, or our partner, or even a therapist, to keep us sharp, humble, and honest, to call us on our shit. We can let them be a mirror for us to see our reflections clearly. Then, when we can better see and understand our obstacles and triggers, the causes and conditions at play, we can work more skillfully to remove them or prevent them from arising in the first place. Finally, the Buddha tells us that the key to cultivating equanimity is wise attention, being continually mindful from moment to moment without losing the thread. If we're aware of the selfless, insubstantial, ever-changing, interconnected nature of being, not centered anywhere, but instead embodied in the all-pervasive space of knowing, where our perspective is wide open and our hearts connected, this becomes the cause for our next moment of equanimity. Well, let me leave you with the Buddha's words, his own spontaneous expression of love, a prayer we memorize in our home and work hard to live up to. May you be skilled in goodness. May you be able, honest, and upright, straightforward, and gentle in speech, humble, modest, and simple in living. May you remain composed and calm, not proud and demanding in nature. May you do nothing the wise would reprove. May you wish in gladness and in safety that all beings be at ease, that they be happy, safe, and secure, whatever living creatures there be, without exception, strong or weak, omitting none, the short, tall, big, and small, whether seen or unseen, living near or far, born or unborn, may all beings be happy. May none deceive or despise another. May none through anger or aversion, through hatred or resentment, wish harm on another being. As a mother protects with her life, her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart may you cherish all beings, radiating goodwill and kindness over the entire world, spreading upward to the skies and downward to the depths, outward and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, may you sustain this recollection. With virtue, vision, and purity of heart, holding no longer to selfish or crooked views, and being released from all sensual desires, may you be free from suffering. May you truly be at peace. Exercises and reflections. Tonglen is a Tibetan word that means taking and sending. Tong means sending out or letting go, and Len means receiving or accepting. This practice originated in India and was brought to Tibet in the 11th century by the Indian master Atisha. It's part of the 7 points of mind training and is a core meditation practice within each of the main Tibetan Buddhist lineages. So the practice involves taking in the suffering and pain of others and sending them joy, well-being, and peace. When we see or feel suffering, we breathe it in, fully feeling, accepting, and transforming it. Then we breathe out loving kindness, release, and openness. Many people shudder at this idea, thinking things are already bad enough without taking on the suffering of others. Our normal tendency is to hold on to the good and keep away from the bad. But Tonglen reverses this tendency. We give away the good and welcome the bad. Though we might initially think this is harmful, when we take on the suffering of others, especially those we don't like, we're not really taking on their suffering in a literal sense. Instead, we're confronting our own resistances and aversions. We acknowledge the immense energy associated with resistance and aversion, and we gradually reclaim this lost energy. By doing so, we break down the walls between ourselves and life around us, allowing our hearts to open and become more responsive to the suffering of others. This is the true essence of the practice. The underlying principles of Tonglen is that our problems are not caused by difficult emotions or troublesome people and situations, but by how we react to these things, how we shut them out of our minds and hearts. Tonglen helps us become more aware of how our mind closes down and contracts when we push things away, whether it's people or emotions, and how this reaction makes us suffer. Recall the last time you saw someone you didn't like, and feel your body instinctively tense up. With Tonglen, we actively open to this discomfort and resistance, drawing it toward us by breathing it in, rather than following the normal patterns of closing down and pushing it away. Then, we open outward with kindness and spaciousness as we breathe out. In this way, we work directly with the mind's tendency to contract inwardly, shut down, and disconnect from the flow of life. So, go ahead, give it a try.